Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 143, I chat with AV journalists Tom Norton, Chris Boylan, and Piero Gabucci about what we expect to see at the upcoming CES show. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded January 4th, 2013, episode 143, CES Preview. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. This week, we are talking about the upcoming CES show and what we expect to see there. On the panel today are three respected home theater audio-video journalists. We have Tom Norton, senior editor from Home Theater and HomeTheater.com. Hey, Tom, welcome back to the show.
Howdy.
Next, we have Piero Gabucci, who's a senior editor at Secrets of Home Theater and High Fidelity at HomeTheaterHiFi.com. Piero, your first time on the show. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Scott. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And finally, Chris Boylan, the editor-in-chief at Big Picture Big Sound at BigPictureBigSound.com. Chris, your first time also on the show. Happy to have you with
us. It is. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, it is. I'm happy. All of us are going to be going to CES next week, and this show will give you a preview of what we expect to see there. Now, while we're recording the show on Friday, it'll be posted on Monday, but those of you who are watching live, as I know many of you are, at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv, can post questions for us about what you'd like to see us cover at CES. Some of you may, in fact, be going to CES, so you might want to tip as to what to see. So that's what we're talking about today, and you can certainly post your questions in the chat room, and I'll be looking at that during the show and pass along as many questions as I can.
Scott, are we really on Twit TV? Is that, did you come up with that? I don't know if I like being on Twit TV.
No, believe it or not.
What do you think? Twit
TV. Chris, you should be right at home.
Now, I must tell you guys, as far as I know, Leo Laporte, who is the chief twit, and that's what it says on his business card, came up with Twit this week in tech before Twitter.
Oh.
So, he should be suing Twitter, I think, but I'm sure he's not. Anyway, no, we are on twit.tv, live.twit.tv now, and later you can get the podcast at twit.tv/HTG, Home Theater Geeks. It's also on iTunes and all over the place, and a lot of people download it, and I'm very happy and grateful that they do. Okay, so CES. For me, the big story, I think, that's going to be there, one of them anyway, is 4K, which, of course, is a shorthand for roughly 4,000 pixels across by 2,000 pixels down, or about four times the resolution of current HD technology, which is referred to as 1080p, roughly 2,000 pixels across by 1,000 down, 1920 by 1080 to be exact. There are a couple of different 4K standards, including one, the one that we're going to see at CES called Ultra HD, which is actually, what is it, 3840 by 2160 to be exact, which is exactly four times 1920 by 1080. Now, you guys have seen some 4K. I know, Tom, you have, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And Piero, have you ever seen a 4K display at this point?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Some of the JVC displays and some of the other Sony's, they're fantastic images, especially larger screens.
Exactly right. And that's the point. Chris, I know you've seen 4K as well. What's your initial impression of it?
Well, I think that, as you said, it really makes the most sense when you're looking at screen sizes of 80 inches or above. Below that, a 65-inch, I think, 1080p is good enough for most people. I mean, it really does provide a lot of detail depending on how close you are. But I think one of the advantages of 4K that really shouldn't be minimized is, 3D on a passive set. Not that everybody's crazy about 3D, but 3D on a passive set like the LG's, really doesn't look that great before 4K because you're splitting that 1080p resolution in half. 3D through passive glasses on the LG in full 4K resolution actually looks pretty good. It's a really nice, deep, detailed image, and it maintains a lot of the depth that you expect without any of the side effects of active glasses.
I agree completely. That is, for me, probably the most important aspect of 4K displays right now is to see 3D with passive glasses or even no glasses. And
yes.
And now, have you guys gotten the press release from a company called Stream TV? They're doing something called Ultra D 4K, glasses free 3D on a 4K panel. Have you guys gotten that press release?
Yes, I think I got it.
Actually, JVC was showing glasses-free 3D on a 4K panel at last CES, but I don't know if that's made it very far into production. Do you know whose TV they're going to be using for that, Scott?
As far as I know, from what I read in the press release, it's the giant Chinese manufacturer called Hisense.
Oh, Hisense. Okay, they have their own press event, I think, on Monday, right?
I think they do. We're talking, there's a press conference also about this Ultra D 4K thing from Stream Networks at the same time as Panasonic's press conference. So I'm going to go to this Panasonic press conference because I need to cover that. But Stream TV, this Ultra D 4K, will have a booth in Central Hall, I'm pretty sure it is. And so I'm definitely going to stop by there and check it out because I think that's pretty important. Speaking of 3D, glasses free in particular, you've got that. And you've also got Dolby, which has displayed its glasses free 3D. Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen that? Piero, did you ever see the Dolby one?
That I haven't seen, no.
If you get a chance to this year, you should. It's the best glasses free 3D that I've ever seen from anybody. Toshiba had it last year on a 4K display, and it was pretty funky looking. Tom, you've seen the Dolby, haven't you?
I don't believe I have, to be honest with you. I heard that. I did see the Toshiba. Yeah, that left a little bit to be desired.
Is Dolby at the Venetian, though, showing that?
Yes. On the main Dolby floor. Is at the Venetian. So, okay. Piero, you're gonna have the best opportunity of any of us probably to see it because you're spending most of your time at the Venetian this year, right?
Well, since most of the audio or two-channel world is at the Venetian this year, it allows me to get away from the convention center. So, absolutely, I'll spend most of my time at Venetian.
Right.
Several upper floors and several lower floors. I do know Dolby is there. I just didn't know whether they'd be showing their display there or not.
I think they will. So I definitely recommend that you go check it out because I was pretty impressed with it. We're going to get to what else is going to be at the Venetian and two-channel audio and so on in a bit, but let's hold that off. Chris, have you seen the Dolby glasses-free 3D?
I have not. I know there's a Dolby event going on in San Francisco, I think either today or yesterday, and that must have been one of the things they were showing. Is it a Dolby-branded display?
Yes. Well,
it is.
Dolby
is it their reference
display,
monitor?
I don't think so. It's their reference monitor, yes.
Okay.
Which is a professional monitor, very expensive. They are licensing. They developed this technology in conjunction with Philips, of all people, to produce this 3D without glasses, and I think they implemented it on their reference monitor, but I think what they ultimately want to do is license it to other manufacturers. Now, of course, that poses a problem because 3D, isn't really very exciting anymore. I mean, 2 years ago, I think at CES or three, it was like the big thing. It's holy smokes, 3D. And then the trend towards excitement about 3D has definitely fallen off, at least at home. Don't you think, Tom?
Yeah, I would have to say that it's hard to judge because, you can't get a TV, a, moderately expensive TV anymore that doesn't have 3D built into it. So you don't know really if people are buying the new set because it's 3D or it's because they need a new set. I guess if we have statistics as to how many extra pair of glasses were sold, I'm not sure if there must be statistics on how many 3D discs are being sold, that would tell us more about how big it is.
Yeah, exactly. Effin Dunn in the chat room is asking, what about Samsung's Square TV? Now, have you guys seen anything about that? That's kind of interesting. It's not square, actually. but I know we have a picture of it. It's called, Alex, it's called Samsung Concept TV. And here's the photo. It's been kind of leaked out in a bit of rumor mill kind of style. And as far as I can tell, it's a translucent TV. Now, in this picture here, you can see behind the screen. You can see the shoreline behind the screen, along with the image that's on the screen. Hmm. Now, I personally don't see what the value of that is.
What's the point?
Plus the fact, no one's sure, by the way, in the rumor mill, whether or not that picture shows something actually behind the screen, or if it's a picture on the screen that's meant to coordinate with the background, so it looks like you're looking through the TV.
Like the old Sony Grand Canyon commercial.
Yes, exactly. But they're showing this TV in a vertical orientation. Now, what's the point of that? I mean, Chris, have you seen this at all yet?
I haven't seen Samsung's version. I've seen other transparent LCDs. And one of the coolest implementations of that is on a refrigerator. So you look at the fridge, you can see how many beers you have, and then suddenly an ad will appear saying, "Well, you should buy this other beer." So the transparent LCDs are not necessarily new, but if they're trying to bring something to market, I could see that more for a commercial display than for home. I mean, it's a nice gimmicky, cool looking thing, but would you ever use something like that at home? A transparent TV?
I would.
Maybe it would. Maybe put real artwork behind it. Maybe and then when it's off, you could admire your Degas, and then when it's on,
maybe they're trying to introduce a new aspect ratio, high screen instead of widescreen.
Hey, that's good. Yeah. High screen TV. Somebody in the chat room, who was it? Oh, Effin Dunn said the content will be 16:9 in the middle with banner space above and below for ads.
Don't put it past him.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past him either. Exactly. Getting back to 4K just for a moment. I know we have Sony, LG. They have product that are actually shipping now, 85-inch flat panels that are 4K. JVC also has an 85-inch. They're all based on LG, the same LG glass, as we say. Westinghouse is going to introduce 110-inch 4K flat panel. That's going to be over at the Hilton, or what's now called the Las Vegas Hotel. It used to be the Las Vegas Hilton, as well as 50, 55, and 65-inch models. Now, Chris, you were saying earlier that the smaller TVs, 4K doesn't really make a lot of sense, certainly in terms of resolution, and I have to agree with you.
If we had native content, I think it would be one thing. And Sony really, so far, is the only one who's providing any content. If you buy their $25,000 TV, they give you a nice 4K player. Preloaded with 10 movies, including Spider-Man and some other ones. And that's great. And when it's native, you really can see the difference. But when you're taking a 1080p Blu-ray and upconverting, or what most people are watching, Netflix and Vudu and Amazon Video On Demand, and you start upconverting that to 4K, you really start to see the flaws. I think, again, coming back to a 55-inch TV with 4K, the real advantage is going to be in 3D, I think, because, in the standard 1080p, if you got a passive 3D screen, you can really see those black lines. And you can see that it's half resolution, despite what LG claims and the psycho whatever it is about what's going on there. So I think it makes a difference there. But how are we going to deliver 4K content? I mean, you can't stream it unless everybody's got a T1 line at home. You'd have to download it in advance and then, have some things to select from. Kind of the way the old Vudu model used to work, where you'd order a movie 3 hours in advance, it would download the first third or the first half to your hard drive, and you'd have this really nice high quality HDX video file. But even Vudu is now gone with the cloud and streaming, so who knows where the content's going to come from for 4K?
Well, that is a very valid concern, one that I share. And Sony, of course, has taken care of it, as you say, with a 4K media server that they give you essentially with the TV when you buy the TV. And they're going to include new titles. They're going to send you new titles on Blu-ray data discs, not video discs, because Blu-ray doesn't support 4K as a video format. But as a data disc, it, you know, it'll just store data. And then you throw this into the server, and it copies it onto the server, and then you can watch it from there. So that's one way to do it.
I wonder if they're doing quad layer Blu-rays or something, because 50 gig is not a lot of storage space for a 4K movie.
No, that's true.
And I know the Blu-ray data format does support more than just dual layer, but the Blu-ray you know, media format, as you said, it doesn't support playback of really anything beyond 1080p, not in the Blu-ray spec at least.
Right, that's exactly right. And in terms of streaming, what you said about streaming and delivering 4K streaming wise, I agree that that's problematic, but if I'm not mistaken, YouTube, in fact, does offer some 4K content. It probably looks pretty bad, but the issue of compression comes into play here. Right. And with better and better, more efficient codecs, then we might be able to get 4K in a stream. For example, have you guys heard about the Red Digital Cinema, which makes the Red Epic camera, which The Hobbit was shot on. A lot of movies are shot on it now.
Yeah. They
also are marketing or are starting to take orders, pre-orders for a 4K media server of their own called Red Ray, which will play 4K. And it's got a SD card slot or some sort of memory card slot, so you can add content that way. And they've have a proprietary codec that I think has the bitrate for 4K down to like 20 megabits per second, which is less than Blu-ray uses, ideally, for 1080p.
You said it's down to 20 megabits per second?
Yeah. 20. Yes.
Still hard to stream that, though.
True. Most consumers don't have 20 megabits coming into their house. But some do.
Yeah, it's true. Well, and you said, you know, it's got an SD card slot. That is one way. If they're going to do it as physical media, you'd have a reusable SD card that you might be able to bring into a, you know, a Walmart or something, for lack of a better store. In the future, all stores are Walmart. And you could put the SD card into a machine and just say, this is the movie I want. 10 minutes later, you walk out with it on a drive, and then you copy it over to your server at home. But I don't know. Right. I think physical media is going the way of the dodo bird. I think that Blu-ray is the last
great. I certainly hope not.
physical Tom, media device we're going to have.
No, I'm a major proponent of having physical media. I mean, major. I'm not a downloader. Downloading and streaming, I understand why it's popular. But I don't want to pay for a movie every time. I don't want to pay for the movie every time I want to watch it. That's just one reason. A lot of others.
Right, and you also don't want to have a network connection every time you want to watch the movie as well, which is the problem with ultraviolet.
Well, I may want to watch part of the movie, and I can't do that when I stream it.
That's true. Yeah, well, it's hard. I mean, most of the services do allow you to fast forward and skip around in the movie.
I mean, I would think
quality is why I don't like it. I mean, you know, you take 1080p streams on Netflix, and they really don't look great.
Nope. And you talk about them, the new codec that's going to get 20 megabit per second for 4K. Uh-huh. Well, the question is, every time you keep codec, you lose something when you do a codec. Is it visibly transparent by itself? Never mind the 4K. Is it going to degrade the 4K just to get a higher compression? That I don't know.
That's the question. You know, as the codecs become more efficient, the general claim is that picture quality does not degrade visibly, perceptually. And here we get into the psycho.
At some point, will it? You know, that's
that's the question. Piero, did I hear you trying to get in here?
Well, we were just talking about 4K. We all knew it was coming. We discussed whether there was replacement for 3D at one time, with especially the quality of 4K. But I also wonder if certainly not a disc format, but some sort of USB, high storage USB format, something like that, might solve those kinds of issues. I don't know.
Yeah, it's sort of like a thumb drive or
a thumb drive, right? Every Blu-ray player now will come with a thumb drive or a USB front-loaded.
Pour it on it.
But then are you going to have a shelf full of USB drives with all your movies on it?
That could be a problem.
Hey, I already do. All those press all the press kits we get, by the way, anybody who doesn't go to CES, those of us in the press, we go to these press conferences or go to the booth and they hand us a little thumb drive. I've got literally dozens of them.
Yeah.
Some of them up to 4 gigs, you know, that they just give you with the press material on it. Then you download that to your computer and then you can use that thing for something else.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Tom wanted to collect them. I think that's maybe a way to do it. If it's not in a disc, on a thumb drive of some kind.
Exactly.
And then you can wear it as a necklace, and it would be really high tech and really fashionable at the same time.
It's really hard to get the liner notes on it, though.
That's true. Really tiny font.
That's about marketing and packaging, though, right, Tom?
Yeah.
The demise of cover art. Well, that sort of happened already with CDs moving from LPs down to CD size things and Blu-rays and so on. Cover art just isn't as impressive as it used to be. I remember in college, you know, the record, the cover art was as interesting as the music in some cases.
That's why I still have my LaserDisc collection, man.
Yeah, man. LaserDisc. There you go. Reverb Mike in the chat room is asking about HFR, high frame rate. And I got a question about this from a reader not long ago. You know, when The Hobbit is released, is it going to be in high frame rate on Blu-ray? Let me ask you first, each of you, have you seen The Hobbit in high frame rate? Chris, I'll start with you.
I have actually. I saw it at in high frame rate and in Dolby Atmos at a theater in Manhattan. The Regal Premium Experience, the Ewok 13. It's the only one in Manhattan, by the way, which has everything. It's got Atmos. It's got high frame rate. It's got it's real D3D. And I wasn't irritated. I wasn't annoyed by it. I did feel like it added a little bit to the dimensionality of the film. I know others feel differently about it. But to me, it wasn't a groundbreaking, this is going to change cinema kind of thing. It was just things look a little sharper, a little clearer. You know, I've seen the argument that it takes away some of the mystery, you know, that we're used to seeing that 24p frame rate, and it gives you this like filmic kind of sense, like I'm in another world that doesn't translate as well to 48 frames. But before I answer about how it's going to be delivered, I'll just say I have seen it. I enjoyed it. I didn't think that it was too groundbreaking.
Okay, Tom, what about you?
Yeah, I've seen it. Obviously, you know, Scott knows I've seen it. And in fact,
we went and saw it together.
I saw the movie twice. I saw the movie first in 24 frames and in 2D because I wanted to enjoy the movie absent trying to analyze the picture. I just went to it first, and then I went to the IMAX, not Atmos, but went to IMAX and saw it in 48 frames. I kind of agree with Chris. I didn't hate it. Like I generally hate
damning
or white
with
hate
faint
interpolation on a TV when I'm watching movies. But I didn't hate it. I didn't love it, but I thought it added a little bit to some. I found the distraction of the way the motion looked after about the first 20 minutes. I didn't really notice it that much anymore. I got into the movie. It's like seeing a movie that where the projections is a little bit off. You're really annoyed at first, but if the movie's good, you enjoy it, and you just kind of ignore what the problem is. So I have to say that along with Chris, I don't think it's going to catch on big time anytime soon.
Piero, did you see it?
No, I'm the audio guy here, so I haven't seen it. But it's like
you're allowed to go to movies, Piero. You are allowed.
You know, if it's like interpolation, then I'm not for it. I think it's too distracting. It's too video-like. It's not film-like. But, you know, I think most people prefer not to have that. But I haven't seen it, so I can't really criticize. But,
exactly.
But if it's that
now, have
format.
Piero, have you seen or heard a movie in Dolby Atmos, the new sound system?
No, I haven't.
I'd be interested to know what you think when you do. Try and go see a movie in Dolby Atmos if you can, because it's many more channels than we're used to, than is usual in a theater, with overhead speakers. And the individual sound-emitting objects, the sound mixer takes a joystick and basically runs the sound around the room. It's like an object-oriented mixing situation. It's really pretty good. I tried to go see The Hobbit at 48 frames and Dolby Atmos in the same theater, which was done here in L.A. at one theater. But the projector crashed, and presentation was canceled. Couldn't get it fixed. I was so bummed. So anyway, well, Piero, let me turn to a little bit of two channel here. Get you in on the conversation a bit more. What are you expecting? What press releases have you gotten from companies that will be at the Venetian two-channel audio mostly. Or what are you sort of expecting or hoping and looking forward to seeing there?
Well, you know, unlike video, two-channel audio files move a little bit slower technology-wise. So, and a lot of manufacturers don't really let you know what they're bringing with them. And a lot of times you show up and they're they're making decisions last minute. So a lot of times it's wherever they can get off the shelf themselves to set up, which is kind of interesting. So it's a little less polished, let's say, but I don't think I'm expecting anything unusual this year audio-wise. I'm more curious about sources. We were talking about 4K video. I'm wondering if they're going to be showing more or if we're listening to more high-resolution audio demonstrations from laptops versus CDs. I've seen less and less CDs from manufacturers. So I'm more curious about the source that I'll be listening to than a lot of the equipment itself, the gear itself, high resolution Blu-ray. I don't think we've seen Blu-ray audio demonstrated as much, and I'm hoping to see more and more of that. Of course, that's about manufacturers producing on Blu-ray audio, but I'd like to see more of that. But beyond two-channel, I'm curious to see more surround sound or multi-channel in the Venetian. I'm hoping to see more of that this year than I have in the past.
Now, multi-channel music, such as that produced by iTrax and I think 2L.
HD Trax.
Well, HD Trax is a retailer or a distributor of high-end music. iTrax and AIX Records is an actual producer of multi-channel music. never seems to get much traction in the two-channel parts of these shows. Have you seen, and Pierre, you watch that part of the industry more than I do. Have you seen any movement towards a greater acceptance of multi-channel music, or are people still just two-channel buffs?
Well, you're right. You bring up AIX. I think they had a great demo last year. They you know, we're all striving for this wall, what we call a wall of sound in two channel, and he's certainly brought that to the forefront with their recordings. So I'd like to see more of that. But of course, if you argue that SACD was meant to take up that cause and has sort of waned on that. Which is my opinion. It's still around, but it's not where it could have been or should be. So I think they have a hard time getting two-channel people to listen to surround sound, especially even if it's high resolution, which is a shame. I guess people who are used to buying two speakers and spending $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 for a pair of speakers don't want to spend $50,000 for four. So I think that has a lot to do with it. Besides the amplification issues and things like that,
one of the signs of that is is the fact that so many SACD players that are aimed at audiophiles, the expensive ones, they're just two channel. That's all they have is two channel output. So you play your SACD back in two channel.
Well, I think they accept who their market is, and the audiophiles are two channel people. They're they listen to surround sound. They'll. It's not there. It's not, you know, it's not like listening to a live performance to them. So it puts you in the middle of the orchestra, not putting the orchestra on stage. So, which is a shame. I think it's a tremendous format. And as I said, AIX had a tremendous demo last year using the Teal Room, I believe, and Bryston. And I'm looking forward. I'm hoping he's there again this year.
Well, one thing I'll be curious about is I got a press release about 3 or 4 weeks ago from Magico, a company that makes very expensive audiophile speakers.
Yeah,
they have a center channel speaker.
Really?
And they're going to be showing it at CES. Now, I don't know if they'll just have it on a pedestal, be playing two channel over in one corner, and just have a static display of their center channel. But I'd be curious to see if they have some kind of a surround setup. Of course, their center channel is almost $17,000.
So baby steps. They're going into 3.1, then maybe extra 4.1, and then
yeah.
A lot of audiophiles SACDs are recorded in three channels, so that might be one reason they're trying to appeal to that. But
really, I didn't know that.
Certainly,
well, of course, Of course, if you're going to use a center channel for just for surround music, you don't need a horizontal center channel. You can use three identical speakers up front.
That's right. But one $17,000 Magico is cheaper than one $30,000, since usually you're paying 50 or 60 for a pair of those. But but I imagine they're also trying to appeal to the audiophile who's using his audiophile room to start listening to or watching movies, let's say, which is possible.
Yeah. Now, Piero, you told me offline while we were talking about doing the show that you've started to see some of these high-end audio companies actually demo their products with MP3 files. Really?
Well, I think what's going on is they're getting away from the CD format. You still see it, but most are taking their iTunes library on their laptop and playing whatever they have on it. I think high-resolution files, which they've downloaded, has only been a recent... say the last 2 years. So most who have burned CDs to their laptops are generally recording them in MP3s. And I think a lot of them do it to show off how well even an MP3 sounds on their system, that sort of thing. But yeah, you certainly do still hear MP3 played as demos, which is surprising. But I think the issue is to get away from the CD format. I think that's the issue.
Mm. You also said that digital to audio converters, DACs, are probably going to be a kind of a big thing here. Who are the big players in the DAC world?
Well, I think all the manufacturers are recognizing the need for an outboard DAC to support high-resolution files. Bryston is doing some great things, and Belcanto and... Meridian. I think there's a number of manufacturers who are doing outboard DACs, New Force, and a number of them from a variety of prices as well, price range from several hundred dollars to as much as $20,000 or $30,000 for an outboard DAC. with high resolution, they're looking at higher bit rates, and the DaVinci now I think is up to 384. Bit rate,
32 bits, 384 kilohertz sampling rate, which is insane. I mean, I don't think anything is recorded at that high a bit depth and sampling rate.
That's correct. Although they argue their upsampling will sound like it, but most are producing 24 bit 192 DACs, outboard DACs. But also, I think what you'll be seeing is integrated. Units with amplifiers, two-channel, inboard DACs, that sort of thing, with potential computer playback connections, that sort of thing. I think that's what you'll also start seeing more of.
Tom, you've had some experience with DACs, have you not?
A little bit, mostly a built-in DAC, so recently.
How about Chris? How about you? Have you looked at all at outboard DACs?
I think the last time I bought an outboard DAC, it was an Audio Alchemy. So that should tell you how long ago that was. Maybe 1987, maybe 1988.
Probably 98.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
Still.
It was a while ago.
It was a while ago. Okay.
Such video files.
The other thing, just to wrap up the audio portion of our entertainment here, not wrap it up entirely, but Piero, you mentioned to me the rising interest in Class D amplifiers. Now, these are amps that are—they're not exactly digital; they're sort of digital in a way, but they're very efficient. They use a lot less power for the amount of power they produce audio-wise. But they haven't been audiophiles haven't been a big fan of them. Are they coming around now? Have Class D amps gotten that much better?
Nope. I think you'll see more of them. I don't know if they'll be mainstream in the audiophile world. I think it all started really with car amplifiers because they do run cool. You can throw a lot of power at them. But I don't know if they'll become so popular, but they are being built. I think one way to look at it might be a hybrid, where we're talking about Class D amplifiers with perhaps tubes in the input or output section of the amplifier, which adds warmth as a tube would do. So yes, I think you'll see more Class D, but I don't think you'll see the traditional Class A or AB type of amplifiers replaced anytime soon. As I said, audiophiles move very, very slow. And
that is true. Beatmaster in the chat room says they implemented in demo MP3 because their previous customers are dying out age-wise. audiophiles do tend to be a somewhat older crowd, partly because they need more disposable income to afford that hobby.
I would have agreed with that 2 years ago, but I think this new vinyl resurgence has actually surprisingly brought in younger people into the audiophile world. I see more turntables on campuses again and things like that. I have a 21-year-old son who's friends have turntables, and so I think that has turned them on to music again, and who are traditional MP3 listeners. So I don't think they play MP3 for that reason for demos, but I think the vinyl resurgence has had a tremendous influence on young people as well, which is fantastic.
I think the vinyl resurgence, a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's a lot of record stores selling used vinyl fairly cheap.
And that certainly appeals to the young.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you may call it, that's true and not true, that you may call it fashionable. If you've been trying to buy new vinyl lately, it's actually very expensive. The reissues are as much as $50 for a single album. So yeah. I would love to see them keep prices down so young people will continue to buy them, so I don't, you know, you can go to used record stores, but there's still gear to buy. You have to buy turntables and you have to buy a preamp for it and that sort of thing. But, it's healthy. It's healthy for the two channel world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Techless in the chat room is asking, doesn't Bel Canto make a lot of Class D equipment?
Yes, they do. I believe.
They do. Don't I couldn't tell you what model numbers they do. I've seen Anthem introduced a monoblock Class D 1,000-watt per channel monoblock a couple of years ago. That's had a tremendous influence. But you will start seeing more and more. Rogue Audio introduced a hybrid called the Medusa last year for about $4,000. It sounded terrific. I think that's the way to go with Class D, is to put some analog in the stage somewhere. But I think that would be the best scenario for the audiophile world, is to see Class D in a hybrid condition. It's mm-hmm. not the first, of course. It's been around Moscow, so it's been around.
Okay. Well, before we continue, we got a lot more stuff to cover here in a little bit of time. I do want to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. And we were talking about streaming earlier, and in fact, streaming may supplant physical media. Some of us hope not entirely, but certainly streaming is here to stay. And Netflix is, as you all know, I'm sure, at the forefront of that effort. They offer thousands of TV episodes and movies that are streamable to just about any consumer electronics device you happen to have, including TVs, Blu-ray players, game consoles, computers, of course, smartphones, tablets, even dedicated boxes like Roku and Boxy. Anything just about with a chip in it, as Leo is fond of saying, will have a Netflix app these days. And if you sign up for one low monthly fee, you can stream as much of that content as your little heart desires. You can even start on one device and finish on another, so it represents the ultimate in convenience. Now, for Twit listeners, those few of you who might not have already signed up for Netflix, the company is offering a free 30-day trial. Just go to netflix.com/twit and start that 30-day free trial and see what you think about the convenience and extensive library offered by Netflix. Be sure to use that URL. That's netflix.com/twit. Okay, a couple more things I wanted to talk about back in the display world. And that is, what the heck happened to OLED? It was a huge splash last year at CES 2012. LG and Samsung both showed us 55-inch OLED TVs and said, we'll be shipping them this year. Well, that's now last year, and they still haven't shipped. Are we going to see OLED at CES, or are they going to kind of quietly say, pay no attention to what we showed you last year? Chris, Sorry, Tom. Let me start with Chris.
Okay. I think we are going to see OLED. I mean, if you listen to LG, they say that they'll have their first model in Korea next month, and they're accepting orders now. Unfortunately, the price went all the way up from $8,000 to $10,000, and that's in a 55-inch screen size. So the market, I'd say, for that is exceedingly low. I think it was an NPD research report, or one of the analysts estimated that the yields are as low as 10 to 15%. So that means of every 100 that you make, you're only getting 10 or 15 that can be used as an actual TV. That's terrible. And that's why I think that we haven't seen them a little sooner. The when the yield goes down or is that low, then the costs are extremely high. And when you could buy a 55-inch, you know, LED LCD TV from a name brand for $1,000, you know, which you can now. I mean, they had all kinds of specials this Black Friday. How many people are going to run out to buy a $10,000 55-inch TV? Even if it is a lot better. I mean, OLED TVs look gorgeous. They have excellent black levels. They're self-emissive, so they don't have the problems of a backlit system. I love them. But I think that unless they can really either improve or change the manufacturing process, we're not going to see, I would say, commercial or wide-scale OLEDs for a while. If they do, and if Panasonic and Sony can get together and get this alternate manufacturing process, which uses printing, to successfully create OLEDs, then you could potentially reduce the cost of manufacturing by an order of magnitude.
And presumably increase the yield at the same time.
Exactly. And that's what my hopes are pinned on. I don't know anything. I haven't heard anything under NDA, but I really am hoping that Panasonic and Sony have some news soon about their OLED story, because you know, plasma and LED are pretty much as far as they're going to get in picture quality, I think. And OLED is a whole other order of magnitude better, thinner. It's energy efficient. I really look forward to seeing it. I think, you know, they can't work miracles. So I'm hoping for some big news from the Japanese manufacturers soon.
Yeah, Tom, what did you have to say?
Well, I'd agree with all that. I'd say that it's interesting so far that the two manufacturers that are at least made the most splash, at least last year, with OLED were Samsung and LG, both Korean companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Japanese companies seem to be either slow at it, or actually the two TV companies that seem to be in the best shape financially are LG and Samsung. Most of the Japanese manufacturers are having big problems. So, you know, spending money on R&D, I guess they feel they have to, because, as Chris just said, there's not much further to go in plasma or LED unless somebody decides to start making Kuros again. So,
well, I mean, and here's a very disturbing rumor that I read about in, I forget where it was. It might have been a Korean or a Japanese news source. But there was certainly a story about a rumor that Panasonic might be getting out of plasma. They lost $9 billion last year, mostly in their display division. Yeah. If that's true, I'm really unhappy.
Yeah, well, there actually have been rumors floating around that there are some TV manufacturers that would like to get out of manufacturing TVs, period.
Yeah.
Because they're losing too much money. But, of course, there's some companies that are pretty much strictly TV, but most of the companies are, I'm like, Sony probably gets, they make a lot more besides TVs, for instance, but they're known for their TVs.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
What that would do to their reputation, if they got out of TVs, they might save money on TVs, but they'd have to tread water on the rest of their stuff.
Exactly.
Right, and I think the same for Panasonic. Panasonic's TV business is not a significant portion of their overall business. They're big in solar. They're big in batteries. They're big in home appliances. They're big in a lot of different markets. But the perception about Panasonic is the same, I think, as Sony. They make great TVs, right? Yep. So if they get out of that business or significantly reduce their manufacturing in that business, it does hurt the brand overall.
I've always thought it interesting that if you translate the Panasonic name, it's all sound.
Yeah, leave it to Tom to come up with an anagram for Panasonic. Yeah. That's pretty good. Somebody in the chat room here was asking about Westinghouse. And I think I mentioned earlier that they're going to have a 110-inch 4K on display, as well as a 50, 55, and 65, which, as we talked about earlier, probably too small to really see any benefit of 4K in terms of 2D content, but it will certainly help with 3D content if you're interested in that sort of thing. NPD DisplaySense, Chris, you mentioned that earlier, projects that ultra 4K, ultra HD, or this 3840 4K sort of, will account for only 2% of display sales by 2017. So they are not expecting it to be a big seller at first. Mm-hmm. And certainly any new technology is going to be very expensive, which this is. The Toshiba 55-inch, which we expect to see at CES, is said to have a sale price of $8,700. So that's up in that OLED price range territory for 4K at a pretty small size.
I think the lesson of 4K.
I think when you talk about being expensive at first and getting cheaper, the only problem is there are also already available TV technologies that are much cheaper. I mean, it's not like flat panel was very much different than CRT because it really brought something new to the table.
Right. Chris, did you have something to add?
Well, I think what I was going to say is that 4K doesn't really address the major shortcomings with LED and LCD TV. It's the lighting uniformity. It's the inability to really reproduce motion well. 4K gives you more detail. It gives you more pixels. But it's not fixing the issue that most of us as reviewers see in the TVs, which is that, you know, you put up Blade Runner and the opening credits show up and you see the little glow around the edges of the screen and it takes you right out of the movie. So I don't see 4K as this huge panacea that's going to make, you know, LED and LCD TVs look, amazing. I think that it's a subtle improvement over 1080p, particularly in a medium to small screen size. It's not like what Tom was talking about, the transition from analog to digital TV, from these little 30-inch sets to these big 50-inch sets, which, you know, it was a huge difference going from analog to digital. This is not that kind of change.
Yeah, I would agree. And speaking of new technologies, Scott Michaud in the chat room is asking about comparing OLED to SED. Remember SED?
Yep, SED, yep.
Which was
RIP.
RIP. That's totally dead. And we're wondering if somebody else in the chat room earlier said maybe it should be called ODED.
ODED.
I'm not sure I'd go quite that far just yet. I hope not, because it looks great. SED looked great, but that had all kinds of legal issues.
Yeah, yeah. There's lots of, and we don't know behind the scenes on some of these new technologies. We don't really know if behind the scenes they have reliability problems. I mean, we don't know. For instance, we saw SEDs. I saw SEDs demonstrated at a Japanese show a few years ago when I got a chance to go to it. Their big show they have in the fall in Japan, and it looked great. The thing is, will it work more than 100 hours? I didn't know that. You couldn't tell. Maybe it works during the show, and then the next day it's broken.
Well, you know what? Actually, the counter to that is that OLED is actually a really successful display technology in smaller screen sizes. My Samsung Galaxy phone has got an OLED screen, and it looks gorgeous. You know, it's a beautiful screen with deep, rich, saturated colors. But, you know, it's the economies of scale need to be applied, and you have to be able to manufacture them larger for it to make sense in the TV market. But there's a huge, huge business, particularly Samsung, in the smaller screen, you know, OLED displays that are on the market now.
One thing that I'm going to have a meeting about, I don't know if you guys have heard about this or not, but Epson wants to talk about a new standard for measuring brightness of colors. They're calling it color light output or color brightness as distinct from white light output. And they have some. Have you guys seen that?
I've heard from Samsung about it. I mean, sorry, from Epson about it. I think, you know, they're trying to counter the measurement claims of DLP sets. They want to show that LCD is better for projection than DLP, and that the measurements as we're doing them now are not necessarily accurate in their mind. I have seen something about it.
Yep.
Tom, did you see anything about that?
Yeah, the same thing as what Chris just said. I've seen something about it, but I thought it was kind of dubious when I first heard about it, and I haven't heard anything more about it for it's been months now.
Yeah.
But Scott, Piero, you can tell us all about it after you have your briefing.
I will.
All right.
You can bet I will. yeah, it's actually I have some questions about it, and obviously we will talk about it. But they claim that if you measure the – and they've got some stuff from Society for Information Display. They've got some pretty heavy-duty documentation behind this. But if you measure the white light output and then measure the red, green, and blue light output in a particular way using a checkerboard pattern, we can even see it if we put it up there on the screen. Mm-hmm. Ah. There it is. And you measure the amount of light coming off of red, green, and blue in each of these patterns, and then sum them and average them and so on. They should be equal. And in many cases, surprisingly, they aren't. Mm-hmm. That when you test the white output, you get a certain value of brightness or luminance, and then when you do this kind of process, you get a different value, a lower value. I wanted to put up a picture of. What they claim to be are actual photographs off of two different displays. Here they are, projectors. The one on the right has equal values measured for white luminance or brightness and color brightness measured in this way that they have specified. And the one on the left has quite a bit less color luminance. Now, I have a hard time understanding. I mean, white is simply a combination of red, green, and blue. So if you combine them and measure white, and then you measure the red, the green, and the blue separately, I don't quite see how they could be that different. But obviously, well, there you see a huge difference.
Well, they are. I mean, the red, the color standard, the green is brightness of the green is something like roughly 70% of the brightness of the image. The red is around 20 or a little more, and the blue is like 6. That's just part of the standard.
Well,
so
that's true.
They can't be equal.
Well, but they're claiming that it's going to be ideally. So I'm going to ask them these questions. And
they have
anybody...
to change the standard for that to happen, though. They'd have to change the standard for sources. If I'm understanding what they're saying,
I'm not 100% sure I am either. Yeah. Let's see. Anyway, I just wanted to quickly bring that up. Let's finish up here with streaming, because I know that we've been talking about it a little bit. Samsung announced that they're finally coming out with their Evolution Kit. You guys remember that from last year? Samsung said, we have the ability to plug a little thingamabob into the back of our TV and it will update the capabilities for the next year. And now this year, finally, they are bringing that out. New CPU, new graphics processor, more memory, voice and gesture controller enhanced. So on and so on.
Hot Korean model included.
Yes. Now here it is. In fact, is a picture of the Evolution Kit with hot Korean model not included.
Oh,
darn. But it's a little box that they plug right back into the back of the TV. So there's a promise that Samsung has now delivered on.
Well, what is it? What does it update? Chances are, it just updates things like the internet features and maybe changes the menus here. I can't. It's not going to, for instance, improve the edge lighting, the uniformity of the image with edge lighting.
No, that's true. That's true. And in fact, I forgot to mention the 4K display, the 85-inch 4K displays from Sony and LG and JVC are all edge-lit LCD TVs.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like, oh, man.
They're not showing really dark scenes on their demos, I can guarantee you.
Right, exactly. Piero, what is your experience with video streaming? Do you have a Netflix account or a Roku or anything along those lines?
Well, I hate to admit it. I have an Apple TV, which I think is terrific, and I've
there
used it
go.
A long time. And, excuse me. Of course, I got it initially because it was able to download and store a lot of audio material on it, but it's a regular in our household. We use it all the time. So absolutely, it's a great product. But I think now with televisions able to do this and directly from the internet, it's a tremendous thing.
Another interesting thing that I got in my email onslaught from CES is that some of the Westinghouse, again, is going to be introducing TVs with an MHL port. which is a mini high definition link, I think, or I forget exactly what it stands for. Multimedia. Well, except that's what HDMI is anyway.
Yeah.
The MHL stands for something else. Somebody, the chat room, I bet, will be able to tell me what it is in a sec here. But that allows you to plug in the Roku streaming stick, which is this little USB thumb drive sized thing you plug into the TV and it becomes a Roku.
Mobile high definition link. Sorry.
Mobile high definition link. Thank you very much. You got to it before the chat room did. Very good.
Oh, wow.
By the way, Piero,
I'm an expert Googler.
Indeed. iPhone 19508 says Apple TV kicks ass. I don't have one myself.
I agree with that. I still have one of the old formats, which has a hard drive to it. The new ones don't have hard drives, so I actually have both. So I'm hanging on to my old one with the hard drive as well. But yeah, Apple TV is a great product. It's now, for $99. It's a good product.
Yeah, if $99. A lot of these products are in that price range. Roku, Boxy. Let's see. I think Arcos is coming out with a box that adds Android Smart TV to any TV, plus HD video, a video camera for using with Skype and Google Talk and so on, for $130. So we're all in that range. Pierre, I wanted to ask you this. I was under the impression that Apple TV and iTunes in particular was based more on downloading, which is why you would have a hard disk, as opposed to streaming. But the new ones really seem to be more streaming-based. Have I got that right?
That's correct. The new one has no hard drive to it. It's purely streaming or working with your cloud if you want to store your music on the cloud. So,
Right. But it can stream from your own iTunes collection, whether it's music or movies. I have a lot of digital copies from Blu-rays that are on my iTunes on my desktop. And actually, when I lost my Blu-ray for the Avengers, which was terrible, I was still able to watch the movie by streaming it from my computer on Apple TV. So it's helpful for that. If you like to collect movies or even just rent them, they can come from your iTunes collection on your hard drive. So they're only streaming within your network. You don't have to worry about your bandwidth to the outside world, only within your house at that point.
Right, exactly. Now, I expect to see an awful lot of streaming stuff at CES. I've mentioned a couple that I noticed in my inbox. Anybody else see anything of particular note?
Well, I think if I can jump in a second about MHL, the MHL does allow the Roku streaming stick to work, but only if the product has been certified as streaming stick ready or Roku ready is what it's called.
Really?
Yeah, it could potentially work with other devices, but when it's Roku ready, it means that the manufacturer has integrated the control into their menuing system. So I think with Oppo, I haven't tested it yet, because I don't think it's Roku ready yet, but the Oppo Blu-ray player does have an MHL HDMI input. And really the only difference is that it provides power. So it's a standard HDMI connection, but it also provides power to an external device. So you can power up the streaming stick. Or what I think it's probably going to be used for more often is for smartphones and tablets. My smartphone, and I think quite a few others, do have a micro USB output, which actually supports MHL. So that means it can pass 1080p video right over micro USB. But to do that, it does need to get power. So, you know, current TVs, if you want to connect a micro USB output from your phone to a current TV, a lot of the adapters come with a little additional power dongle, which is a real pain in the ass, because then you got a bunch of different cables to plug it in. But with an MHL HDMI connection on your TV, you could take a standard micro USB to HDMI cable, and then you could play the video shot in your phone directly on your TV in 1080p.
Now, another thing I expect to see at CES regarding that exact thing is wireless from your smartphone to the TV. And I expect to see an awful lot of that kind of content or that kind of product, that kind of functionality. iPhone 19508 in the chat room mentioned wireless HDMI, which is one example of that sort of.
DLNA can do that now as well. If you have a DLNA server built into your phone, like the Samsung Galaxy S3, this is not a commercial, then you can actually stream 1080p to the TV without wires as well, but only if your TV supports DLNA.
Ah, my wife just got a Galaxy S3, by the way, and she's quite enamored of it.
Oh, yeah. Where do the Apple police come and collect them all?
It's not funny, Tom.
Tom, were you going to say something about streaming?
Not if I can help it.
Oh, your mother said, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all.
That's right. All right. Piero, how about you? Have you seen much in your inbox about streaming?
To be honest, if I have, I sort of ignored it, but.
Yes,
I'm going to be talking about. You're going to be over at the Venetian talking about Two Channel.
We've all been receiving a flood of press releases from CES about every possible subject.
Especially lately, it's been, inundated. 100 today, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And plenty of stuff that none of us even talk about. And I'm sure when you guys all registered like I did, you specified what you're interested in, right? Video, home theater, that sort of stuff. And yet I'm getting, carry bags and iPhone covers and, all kinds of stuff that I'm not going to cover any of that.
Yeah.
So, I know it's people trying to get press to their booth to see their stuff and to cover their stuff. But, we've come to the end of a great hour of speculation and discussion about what we might see here at next week at CES. It's going to come up in a hustle and a hurry. We've all just got a couple days to pack our bags and hit the road. I do want to thank so much everyone who has been here on the panel. Tom Norton from hometheater.com. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Piero Gabucci from Secrets of Home Theater and High Fidelity. I'm going to certainly want to talk to you about Two Channel once we've come back from the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Scott, for having me. And invite me back again.
I will. Absolutely. And Chris Boylan from BigPictureBigSound.com. Always a hoot and a holler for you. And look forward to seeing you in Vegas as well.
Thank you.
Bye. So next week, we're going to be at CES, obviously. And on Tuesday, this show will be shown on Monday the 7th at its normal time, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern time on live.twit.tv. And it'll also be posted at twit.tv/HTG. While I am and the rest of us are managing to get through the crowds at the press conferences on press day on Monday. Then on Tuesday, I'll be roaming the floor with a camera crew to do interviews at various booths in Central Hall. Mostly the big players. I'll be visiting Panasonic, Samsung, Sony, Sharp, LG, and also DTS, a relatively small booth. But they always do some very interesting things, and they have some very interesting people there. I'll be interviewing a fellow by the name of Jeff Emmerich, who's an extremely well-known recording engineer who worked on two of the Beatles albums, among many, many others. So he's been in the business a long time, really knows his stuff, and I'm really looking forward to talking with him. That won't be streamed live, but it'll be assembled into Home Theater Geeks that will be aired on Monday, January 14th, just right after we get back from the show. So I do hope you'll tune in for that, because it should be a fascinating, longer than usual special edition of Home Theater Geeks live, recorded on the floor, the show floor at CES. You can reach me always at scott@twit.tv. You can read my answers to reader and listener questions at Secrets of Home Theater and High Fidelity at hometheaterhifi.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at HTGeekScott. So off we go to CES. I hope you all have a great week. And until next time, geek out.